Hi everyone, welcome back to Legends of Surgery. I'm your host, Tyler Rouse. For today's show, in honor of St. Patrick's Day, we're going to cover an Irish surgeon famous not for his gifted hands, but rather his brilliant mind, and not one, but two significant discoveries. This is the unusual life story of the one-eyed Irish surgeon, Dr. Dennis Parsons Birkett. Those of you with some medical training may have had your ears perk up at the name Birkett. And you're right, it is the same Birkett that Birkett's lymphoma is named after. And the story of how this came to be, and maybe more importantly, the significance of this discovery, will be a big part of this podcast. But first, let's do a little biographical background. Dennis Parsons Birkett was born in Enniskillen, North Ireland, on February 28, 1911. His father was a civil engineer and surveyor by profession, but was one of the pioneers of modern ornithology, study of birds, and as what may seem to be a totally random fact, was credited as the first to use banding of birds to study their territories. However, this may have influenced our young subject, creating an interest in geographical distribution, which would pay off much later. His family had a number of members in the church, and his upbringing provided him with a strong evangelical and fundamental Protestant belief system, which would drive his desire for missionary work in the future. As mentioned, Birkett only had one eye, which to me makes it fairly amazing that he could become a surgeon. Here's the story of how he lost it. In a schoolyard fight between two groups of boys when Birkett was 11 years old, his glasses were broken and his right eye was injured. He spent 5 weeks in hospital, and despite all efforts, the eye had to be removed and replaced with a glass one. Following this, he and his brother were sent away to school in Wales and then England. Birkett entered Trinity College in Dublin to study engineering like his father, but given his religious upbringing, he felt an evangelical calling to be a doctor and so transferred to medicine. After graduation, he did a surgical training and obtained a fellowship at the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh. Now it was 1938, and uncertain of where to begin his career, he spent 5 months as a ship surgeon on the freighter Glen Shiel, a cargo ship that ran between Great Britain and China. As an aside, I'd like to do a post on the history of the ship surgeon. I think that'd be pretty interesting. So once his 5 months was up and he returned to England, Birkett decided to be a surgeon first and a missionary second, and hoped to work with the colonial service in West Africa. He first found work as a resident surgical officer at the Prince of Wales Hospital in Plymouth, which is where he met his wife. Now, for those of you paying close attention to the dates, you may have been wondering about Birkett being in England at the outbreak of World War II. At the time of the Dunkirk invasion in 1940, Birkett volunteered for the Royal Army Medical Corps and was turned down because of the loss of sight in one eye. The colonial service also turned him down, but he was determined and reapplied that same year, this time successfully. Following his training, Birkett was posted to a military hospital in Mombasa, Kenya in 1943. He spent 18 months as an army surgeon and learned Swahili in the process. Near the end of the war, he reapplied to the colonial service and this time was accepted, moving to Uganda in 1946, where he was the solo medical charge for a region of 300,000 people with a primitive 100-bed hospital. Before leaving for this assignment, Birkett submitted his MD thesis to Trinity College called Spontaneous Rupture of Abdominal Viscera, which was awarded the following year. It was in this rural area of Africa, called Lira in the Lango district of Uganda, where he made his first association between geography and disease. Birkett realized that the incidence of hydrocele, a collection of fluid around the testicle, had a 30% incidence in adult males in the eastern region, and only 1% in men from the western region. It was later shown by others that this was due to the distribution of a parasitic disease called filariasis, caused by a roundworm. So following his service in the bush, Birkett was appointed surgeon to Mulago Hospital in Kampala, Uganda, which is the capital, and a lecturer in surgery at Makerere College Medical School. Hope I'm saying that right. In his first years there, his work was mainly around service to the population. I did read this one nice anecdote. Apparently, limb amputations were fairly common, but there was no way to supply artificial limbs. So Birkett went to the Royal National Orthopaedic Hospital in London for 5 months, covering orthopaedic surgery and recent advances in artificial limb technology, which he brought back to Kampala and initiated the local production and fitting of simple orthopedic devices out of scrap metal and broomsticks. During this period of service, he would meet the first patients that would lead to his great revelation. In July of 1957, he saw a 5-year-old boy with swellings in all 4 quadrants of the jaw. He was unsure of the diagnosis, writing, quote, "We had seen children with single tumor jaws before, but never anything like this," end quote. A few weeks later, while visiting a district hospital, he saw another boy with the same jaw pattern, commenting, quote, A curiosity can occur once, but two cases indicated more than a curiosity, end quote. This second boy was found to also have an abdominal mass. Knowing he was on to something, Burkitt did a meticulous search of the hospital records looking for children with jaw tumors. He found these were often associated with tumors at unusual sites like orbit, kidney, liver, adrenals, abdominal, lymph nodes, and often in young children. Now, since the histology was available, Burkitt reviewed this and saw that they were all composed of small round blue cells, making them all examples of a single entity. And in fact, the histology description of Burkitt's lymphoma is that of single, larger, light-colored cells on a background of small, dark cells, the so-called starry night pattern. Burkitt published his findings in the British Journal of Surgery in 1958 in an article called A Sarcoma Involving the Jaws of African Children, and it is available online if you have access. Although this paper was initially all but ignored, the realization that this was a lymphoma, in articles published a few years later, brought international attention. But it wasn't just the discovery that these were all the same tumor, but rather that there was a geographical distribution pattern to the phenomena. Burkitt contacted colleagues throughout Africa, distributing a questionnaire to government and mission hospitals, and even bringing in a cancer epidemiologist from Johannesburg to study this. Plotting the cases on a map, he discovered that the tumors were confined to a band across Africa running 10 degrees to the north and south of the equator, which became known as the lymphoma belt. Now, although he was a surgeon, Burkitt quickly realized that surgery was not an option for these lesions, and there was no radiation therapy facilities available in sub-Saharan Africa. In 1960, a team from Sloan Kettering in New York visited Mulago, they were in Africa to work in Nairobi, and brought the cancer drug methotrexate. They treated a boy named Israel at Burkitt's house and saw a dramatic response over a few days. In a clever, if now considered somewhat unethical maneuver, Burkitt was able to get the drugs for free. In his own words, quote, "Chemotherapy agents were obtained free of charge from the manufacturers, who were approached in an attitude of begging, clothed in the appearance of offering opportunities. In Western countries, it was difficult to assess the effect of chemotherapy, because in most patients, radiotherapy had also been used," end quote. So basically, the deal was, Burkitt would provide unadulterated guinea pig test subjects to the manufacturers to test their product in exchange for free medication. And his approach of short, high-dose treatments, sometimes only a single dose, as the patients would vanish back into the bush, still got excellent results, drawing more attention from oncologists worldwide. He also became a bit of a figure in popular media and was referred to as, quote, "the simple bush surgeon," end quote. Burkitt went to London in 1961 and gave a lecture to the surgical division at the Middlesex Hospital entitled "The Commonest Children's Cancer in Tropical Africa, a Hitherto Unrecognized Syndrome." In the audience that day was a young medical virologist named Anthony Epstein. Okay, now some of you may have already gotten ahead of me here. Epstein was stunned by Burkitt's description of the tumor having a distribution associated with temperature, altitude, and rainfall, because that implied a biological cause. Burkitt sent Epstein samples of the tumor, and along with Yvonne Barr, an Australian physician, they published "Virus Particles in Cultured Lymphoblasts from Burkitt Lymphoma." The Epstein-Barr virus had been discovered, making it the first virus shown to be associated with cancers in humans, opening the door to an entirely new field of oncology study. Burkitt resigned his post with Mulago Hospital in 1964 and began to work for the Medical Research Council, first in Kampala and then in 1964 transferring to London. The focus of his work was on the distribution of cancer and other diseases in Africa and beyond, and this is where the second of his great observations germinated. Burkitt met a retired surgeon captain, T.L. Cleave, a meeting which Burkitt himself described as one of the most important of his professional life. Cleave's hypothesis was that modern processed diets enriched in sucrose, fat, and salt, and low in dietary fiber, were responsible for many of the common illnesses of developed countries. This started him down the path linking diet and illness. After this meeting, Burkitt made a list of diseases that were only diagnosed infrequently in African hospitals. Here's what he discovered in his own words. Quote, "In Africa, treating people who live largely off the land on vegetables they grow, I hardly ever saw cases of many of the most common diseases in the United States and England, including coronary heart disease, adult onset diabetes, varicose veins, obesity, diverticulitis, appendicitis, gallstones, dental cavities, hemorrhoids, hiatus hernias, and constipation. In 20 years of surgery in Africa, I had to remove exactly one gallstone," end quote. Burkitt attributed this not just to diet, but specifically the high-fiber diet of Africans. Is it starting to sound familiar? Burkitt found like-minded scientists and began to publish on the subject, including a seminal paper in the journal Cancer called Epidemiology of Cancer of the Colon and Rectum, which is available free online. Here he makes the connection between diet and illness, postulating that low-fiber diets cause increased transit time and reduced fecal bulk with drier, less fluid intestinal contents, which causes increased intraluminal pressures and increased time of exposure of contents, including toxins, to the intestinal mucosa. In fact, Burkitt even explored the role of different gut bacteria in different populations, predating the current interest in the microbiome and its role in disease by over 40 years. So in 1975, Burkitt and his collaborator, Dr. Trowell, wrote a book which gave a comprehensive survey of their fiber theories and their views on disease prevention through high levels of dietary fiber. He even took this to the public, publishing a book called Don't Forget Fiber in Your Diet to Help Avoid Many of Our Commonest Diseases. Given that catchy title, it is little wonder that it became an international bestseller, launching the high-fiber diet, along with whole grains, into the mainstream, and earning himself the moniker The Fiber Man. Along those lines, Burkitt made some other observations about the more natural behaviors of Africans, condemning the modern practice of not immediately evacuating the bowels when the desire is felt, as Africans would. As well, he noted that the squatting position was a more natural way to defecate than sitting on a toilet. And some sources state that he made the claim that this was at least as important as dietary fiber in preventing disease. Given his writing on intestinal transit times and intraluminal pressures, this does make sense, although I couldn't find a direct source for this. Interestingly, the study of squatting and health has become a popular topic in the media and even in the medical literature. Now, if you haven't seen the commercial for Squatty Potty, go look it up right now. It takes a pretty whimsical approach, but does demonstrate the principle very well, and I'll see if I can post it on Twitter and or Facebook, and don't take this as a product endorsement. So the link between dietary fiber and colon cancer is now being debated in the literature, although the link with other disease processes, including diverticular disease and coronary vascular disease prevention, is pretty well established. Regardless, Burkitt's advocacy of prevention over simply treating disease was certainly ahead of its time. And here's a popular quote that you'll see attributed to Burkitt. Quote, if people are constantly falling off of a cliff, you could place ambulances under the cliff or build a fence on the top of the cliff. We are placing all too many ambulances under the cliff, end quote. Dennis Burkitt suffered a stroke at his home in February of 1993 and passed away shortly thereafter at the age of 82. In his lifetime, he made an impact in not one but two large fields of study, cancer virology, and the link between diet and disease. And although this podcast is about the history of surgery, and Burkitt's achievements were made with his mind and not with his scalpel, Dennis Parsons Burkitt was one of the true great surgeon scientists of the 20th century and is worth knowing about. As you may have noticed, he's very quotable, and threat I've only given you a taste of this, but I'll leave you with just one last short and funny but poignant one. Quote, America is a constipated nation. If you pass small stools, you have to have large hospitals, end quote. Well, that wraps up another episode of Legends of Surgery. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to take next week off as it's March break, but I'll be back in 2 weeks with the very first in the series Better Know a Physical Exam Sign, looking at the Sister Mary Joseph nodule. So please rate the podcast on iTunes and leave a comment there. You can follow me on Twitter at Surgery Legends, like us on Facebook at Legends of Surgery, send an email at legendsofsurgery@gmail.com. As always, I'd love to hear from you and about your thoughts on the podcast or ideas for future episodes. Thanks for listening.